Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 6th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, we have visitors from France. Homebrewer Philip Lamb and his wife, Tiffin, join Andy and me for a conversation about French beer culture, home brewing in France, and what it's like to go pro there. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter, I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everyone clicking on the amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. And don't forget, there is now an amazon.co.uk link on there, too. We have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory now, too. Just a couple of notes before the interview this time. The latest Brew Your Own magazine Basic Brewing Radio Collaborative experiment is underway. Will fermenter shape on the homebrew scale affect your brew? Split a batch of beer, ferment it in two different fermenters, and let's see if we can spot any differences. Be sure to take note of all your gravity readings, final and original, lag times, sensory perceptions, etc. And the deadline that Chris and I set last week was November 15th, so listen to that show in the archives from last week to get more details. And we appreciate everybody who's participating in that. Also, I have to thank Aaron from Cheyenne, Wyoming, for the inspiration for the experiment. I failed to mention Aaron's name last time. It was his email that got the ball rolling, so I appreciate that. And sorry, I fully intended after the interview to come back on and say Aaron's name, but you know how it goes. I'm old. This Saturday, October 8th, I will be in Hattiesburg, Mississippi for the second annual Outlaw Homebrew Competition. The guys at the Keg and Barrel Brew Pub in Hattiesburg, whom you've heard on this show, they've invited me down for the event. You know, homebrewing is still illegal in Mississippi, hence the name of the event, the Outlaw Homebrew Competition. So I'm looking forward to that, and if you're in the neighborhood, check it out. You can find more details at kegandbarrel.com, and I hope to see you there, and look forward to shows next week from there, reporting from the land of, or one of the lands of illegal homebrewing. Also, here's another event reminder. I told Will in Columbus, Ohio that I'd give this a mention. SODS in Columbus, Ohio is hosting a Beer for Boobs competition with Lisa White of White Labs and Weasel Boy Brewing to raise money for breast cancer awareness. It's open to all BJCB categories. The competition will be on November 12th at Weasel Boy Brewing in Zanesville, Ohio. Entry dates are October 26th through November 4th, and registration is open now until November 4th. So for more information on the Beer for Boobs competition in Columbus, Ohio, check out beerforboobs.brewcompetition.com. Sounds like a good event for a good cause. So good luck to everybody up there. Now, I've been corresponding with Philip Lamb through email and Twitter and such for a while. Philip was one who emailed from Paris a while back looking for other homebrewers in the area to start up a homebrew club. Well, now Philip is looking to go pro. And he and his family came through Northwest Arkansas this week, and Andy Sparks of thehomebrewery.com and I were lucky enough to spend some time with him in the beautiful weather, sampling and talking about beer. Well, here we are sitting out watching the dog bathe in the kiddie pool out on Andy's happy place. Say hello, Andy.
Hey, everybody.
And here joining us, direct from France. Is it Paris, France?
Yeah, well, I'm
Yeah, we'll say Paris. That's easy enough.
From nearby Paris, we have Philip Lamb.
Hi, how's it going?
And his better half, Tiffin?
Yeah, hello.
Now say your name so that we can hear the correct pronunciation.
Tiffin.
Okay, I was close.
That was very close.
It's the same number of syllables, so and some of the same consonants. So we had a lovely lunch, and your son is napping in Andy's house, which is very, very handy.
To the best of our knowledge.
To the best. He may be screaming, no, we would hear him if he was unhappy, I think. But we were sitting out on the deck in the happy place, and what are we drinking?
So this is a Boule de Vin, which is from 2011. It's number 25 of 352 bottles made. It's a 6% ABV, aged on Fût de Chêne oak for 24 months, and it is quite a sour beer. I would say that perhaps in its young life, it might have been an attempt at a saison or something like that, but it's got this sort of standard IPA sort of light red caramelly color, and it is one heck of a sour beer, but excellent.
So there were only, what did you say, 352 bottles of this in existence?
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow. Mm. What do you think about that, Andy?
I think I'm very fortunate.
And now there are 351.
Indeed. Boy. It is a sour beer. It has some oaky notes. It has some fruity notes. There's some complexities that I look forward to becoming familiar with as it warms up. And this is right up my alley, Phil. You picked well.
Well, I was actually, honestly, I'd never tried this beer before, and I was expecting something along the lines of whiskey barrel type aged sort of thing. But that's okay. You know, I'm glad to, I'm, it's a pleasure to serve.
So. Now you are, give us the kind of Reader's Digest version of your background. You're an Arkansas boy, but you're far from home now.
That's right. So long story short, very long story condensed, is Arkansas to Chicago to New York, where I met my lovely wife, who was foolish or smart enough, one way or the other, we'll find out eventually, to marry me. And then we ended up moving to France and had the baby. That's sort of, you know what, the funny part is, when I was in Chicago for school, I was a big old-style fan. And that was pretty much my go-to beer. And if I wanted something fancy, then it was Sam Adams. when I moved to New York, I got exposed a little bit more to some more interesting beers like Magic Hat No. 9. And then it was only when I got to France and I sort of got back into touch with my my American-ness, my heritage as far as beer goes, that I really got interested in these very interesting beers coming out of the American craft beer scene. And it's unfortunate because, you know, bottle of Pliny I can get, but it's going to cost me the equivalent of $25 a bottle. Mm. You know, if I want the Sierra Nevada just regular pale ale, that's about $8 a bottle. So it's a little bit harder to find them there. And they're not necessarily in the best shape. Sometimes they get shipped badly.
Yeah, as we were discussing earlier, these hoppy beers that are just incredible fresh, if you handle them badly, they do not they don't translate well, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've actually shifted more towards trying to find American beers that are barrel-aged or just anything besides really hop-forward beers, and have had some luck with some of the – well – let's see. What have I had that's barrel-aged? Well, the Goose Island Bourbon County Stout is probably my number one for trying to pick up wherever I can find it in Europe. And stuff like that, it travels pretty well.
So since you can't find good, fresh American beers in France, and I've seen some tweets from Greg Cook from Stone over in Europe. He's trying to invade over there. And hopefully he would, make sure the beers were taken care of as he transported them over there. What is the, I mean, we normally don't think of France as being beer country. We think of France as being wine country. What is the beer culture over there?
Well, the north of France has had a lot of beer history. Over near the Flanders region of Belgium and to the west of that. It's traditionally just where all the beer was made, with the only exception, of course, of the southeastern area around the Alps. Rhône-Alpes, Tiffen, what would you say? What's the region?
Yes, Rhône-Alpes.
Okay, so there we go. The Rhône-Alpes area where they do a lot of German-style beers as well. But that's pretty much it as far as the beer producing regions of France, and they're all they produce some interesting beers and some good beers, but they're all more or less the same style because there's a certain sort of level of expectation that that comes out of that.
Well, there's also in the west of France in Brittany, they're starting an old tradition of craft brewing, but with Celtic touch to it. You know what I'm talking about,
right? Because of the history of the Celts in Brittany, they're going towards the sort of, I don't know if it's Norse necessarily, but the very very ancient methods of brewing with random things that they find on the beaches, that
like
sort of thing.
The bière au frêne that you have in the cooler,
right? And the frêne is what?
It's
can you remind
a tree.
Us?
It's a tree that makes little fruits like acorns, but smaller, and it's a older native.
Yeah, so it's kind of the Brittany equivalent of brewing with pumpkin, shall we say. It's, you know, something that, you know, you had to brew with something, so, well, we'll just throw some of this in there and see what happens.
And I would assume that those beers would either lean away from hops or not have hops altogether?
Well, certainly the ancient ones do, the sort of the ones that follow the older recipes. I mean, maybe there's a little bit of hops in there. I couldn't tell you, but it's certainly not. There's no presence of hops that you can really detect. If you go towards the east and towards the southeast in Rhône-Alpes in that area, you, because of the German influence, you do have a lot of noble hop presence. There's actually a big hop. What would you say? A hop growing farm, a hop producer. I'm not sure. That's doing some interesting things these days now. In terms of hops, which their newest hop is Ramirez. No, that's a Red Sox ball player, I think. No, what's it? The one of the Musketeers, Aramis.
No,
Aramis. There we go. Well, Aramis Ramirez. Close enough.
That's an offshoot.
Yeah. So we'll cut that in the edit, I suppose. Yeah. So they're doing some interesting stuff out there. But in general, you know, the older stuff, you're not going to see a lot of hop presence, but. There is some use of it, but just kind of like a noble pills application.
So you brought us a cooler full of interesting beers. So what kind of we saw some gooses in there. What sort of range of beers are we looking at?
In terms of the stuff that I brought you, well, let's see. We've got a couple of saisons. We've got a couple of sort of your standard. We could go off on a tangent here because this is a bit of a problem in the French beer scene. You have beers that are called specific things. For example, you have a categorization of brune, ambrée, blonde, noire, blanche, and that's it. And those are their categorizations of beer. And so when you buy a beer, it's going to have one of those five things. Or it might say Crique Goose. But that it's not going to go anywhere beyond that. So the label will say one thing, but what it really has is another thing. So going with what is actually in the bottles, you've got kind of a caramelly, sort of an Oktoberfest sort of beer that's got a lot of roasty malt profiles and some malt sugar in there. You've got the Saison that I mentioned. You've got a couple of the Goes that you already mentioned. There's two bottles of the Mega Blend from the 2011 Tour de Goose, which is from, I think, yeah. Well, we've got a photo here that's a great reference, actually. This is the one that I sent. So we have the beer that we're trying now. We have, let's see.
So when you talk about those terms that you mentioned earlier, that refers mostly just to color, right?
That's right. You're not going to, excuse me. You're not going to have much in the way of descriptors like the
style.
BJCP style guidelines. It just doesn't exist, obviously. There's no French translation yet. Most of Europe is like that, unfortunately, with the sole exception for the moment of Britain, where there is an active BJCP program. We're trying to get that sorted in France. I'm doing my best. But the colors are predominant because that's what people see. And if you want to think about it in terms of something that's more applicable to the French sense of alcohol, you have red wine and you have white wine. And you have rosé wine. And because there are no appellations for beer, like there are, you have Côte Rhône, Côte Bonne, Haute Bourgogne, all these different regions that are specific for producing wine because of the terroir. With beer, there's no way to apply that. So they go with the standard, which is color. And for the most part, a lot of these beers that are produced that are Brune or Blanche or whatever have no interesting characteristics. So the only way that you can define them is by their color.
So for instance, with Champagne, it comes from the Champagne region, right? I mean, is it indicative of the kind of mindset of the French thinking of wine versus beer?
Well, you certainly have, you know, expecting some beers to come from certain regions, but the problem is there's no all of any sort of memory of beer history has been more or less completely lost because you have this takeover from Sez, 1664, Kroll, Kronenbourg, Heineken, Leff, and Leff is considered a fancy drink, but it kind of tastes like cardboard, unfortunately. These are the sort of beers that you have, and it's the real issue is that yes, this history did exist. And there was a great deal of interesting things going on. But now the only real denomination between the different types of beer is instead of land or region, it's just color of the label. And so it's sad.
Which kind of surprises me. I mean, Andy, when you think of France, do you think of, I mean, in my mind, I think of connoisseurs who... think of in wine and cheeses and different foods and being very distinctive and distinguished and, you know, and thinking of anything that they put in their mouths as being as having some sort of hierarchy or, you know, some distinguishing characteristics. So it seems to me sort of discouraging that even the French look upon beer in this way.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. You know, we think of the French as being the most, or maybe the most passionate people about the food they have and the wine and everything, gastronomically at least, and love. And
that's another issue.
Completely another issue. We'll talk about another episode. But yeah, you're right. You know, you would think that they would have the same sort of passion about the beers that they are famous for. Now, they're not as famous for as many beers as some places, right? But there are certain beer styles that came from France, or at least came from the French regions way back in history. So you would think, it surprises me too, that there isn't more passion about the things that we see as French beers, maybe the beer de garde and some of the farmhouse ales that we think of as kind of French Belgian or French beers. And we would think, yeah, wow, they would be all about that. That would be what they really are passionate about. But, you know, in the same way you could look at America, and we have the same problems here, right? You know, we have beautiful things that we don't seem to give a crap about, and we have my dog, and I give a crap about her. And other things we seem to make a big deal about that don't seem to really be that big, you know, special, so...
Well, you know what? Let me say this is the difference between France and the U.S. If we look at the U.S. in the 1970s, where it's basically nothing, you know, it's before anything started out west in terms of craft brewing, and it was only Bud Miller Coors, and that was your selection. You had people who, had they known about craft beer, would have been really interested in it and really pushed for it. But there was no organization. There was no structure to give people a channel to express themselves. In France, it's like it is now, as it was here in the 70s, here meaning the U.S., we're trying to get some things started. You have the European Beer Drinkers Guild. I can't remember the exact word, the exact name of the organization. But they're trying to get some things started, basically the European equivalent of CAMRA. But there's nothing there right now to form sort of a coherence around good beer. I've been to several different breweries in France that are making extraordinary beer, and these people are really passionate about what they do, but there's no way of communicating that with other people. The real problem, I think, is that you don't have this organization that exists between all these different breweries, so you have one brewery out there, and for them, they'll be really passionate about it at the beginning, but there's no one to share their passion with, there's no support organization for them, and they quickly basically lose passion, and you have these places that start and get rolling, and then no one hears about them, and then they go out of business.
Because you have to have passion to keep a brewery in business. You got to have people passionate about the beer, and you got to have people buying their beer over the fizzy yellow or brown or amber or whatever whatever color beer that there is. So going back to the 70s in the United States, the home brewing movement was really the movement that kicked up the small breweries and started the craft beer movement. You started the seed that we now are enjoying the fruit of in the craft beer movement in the United States. How is homebrewing doing in France?
Well, it's suffering from the same lack of communication. I started the Paris Homebrewers Club to get people actually meeting. There's a forum. There are a few forums, actually. It's a forum de brasseur amateur, I think, or brassage amateur, that is okay. It's not nearly as active. I'm also on the AHA forum, and we have, you know, thousands of people on there and a lot of really smart people that if you have questions about your beer, go on the AHA forum. Someone will help you out. We don't have anything like that in France, and so we're trying to get those things started. There are some talented people out there, you know, some of them are Americans. It's just in our blood, I suppose. But there are people that really want to do interesting things, and I think that all you have to do is show them that a system exists, that they can meet other people and learn about different ways of brewing, learn about things that they might be doing wrong and try to improve their beer, that sort of thing, and just give them a conduit for communication. And if that can be established, then I think the real craft beer scene is going to explode in France, because you have the ideas of terroir and excellent cuisine and all these things that already are there for everything else except beer. So it's a switch that needs to be flipped.
So if you are a home brewer, what, I mean, you're talking about online resources, but what physical resources do you have to get equipment and ingredients, and does everything have to be imported, or are there resources there locally that you can get the stuff that you need to brew good beer?
So I'll answer the import question first. The only thing that really, quote unquote, needs to be imported are hops from Cascadia. The sort of very American high alpha acid hops, because they, you know, there's nobody growing them right now, and they're also intellectual property rights, or, well, I don't know what it would be, some kind of territorial, this is my rhizome rights to, you know, things like Chinook and
Simcoe, Amarillo, any of those modern new West Coast hops are all locked up by individual breeders, yeah. So.
And if any of you breeders are listening to me, it's very dangerous to do that, because you have one blight, and then no one is going to ever have Amarillo ever again. So, except for that one guy in France who happened to sneak in late at night. I'm not saying it's me. I can't scale any fences, but, you know, maybe I hired somebody.
There was no fences around those hop fields that I saw. Did you see them?
Well, of course, we were in hop fields that were not...
not controlled, right?
Yeah, we were in, like, nugget fields.
Yeah, they're not worried about those slipping into the public domain.
But the hops are what we do have to import, and so there are a couple of different places that'll do that. that. I will usually go direct to U.S. companies because for dried hops, there's no import-export restrictions that I'm aware of. It's never been a problem in the past. So, fresh hops and hops direct and places like that where you can get the whole leaf or the whole leaf cones or the pelletized. But obviously for East Kent or any kind of noble German variety or anything that's from anywhere in Europe, we can get fairly easily. So in terms of shops, I plan on going to many homebrew shops while I'm here just because I've never been to one. there is one shop. If you are in Europe and you're listening, you will know the shop that I'm speaking of because it is the shop, and it is in Belgium, just outside of Brussels. I'm not going to mention the name because I really don't like them. They have horrible customer service. They have no order tracking. You place an order with them. One time, I needed something fairly quickly to get turned around and paid extra for shipping. I got an email from the guy about 4 days after my order that was just an automated thing saying, we're preparing your order for shipment. Then I emailed him to say, can you give me an update because I need this soon? And he said, actually, we're all leaving on vacation. Didn't you see the notice on the website that said we won't be shipping orders for a month? Well, I went to the website, and yes, it was there at the very bottom of the page in tiny, tiny print. So that's the sort of customer service that we expect for them. However, there is a bright and shiny side to this. There are a few shops that have opened up recently that are kind of the craft beer equivalent to the BMC, that is, these guys in Brussels. There's a place called Humlegarden Ekolager, which is in Sweden, and they are fantastic. They speak English, they speak German, and they speak, obviously, Swedish. They have an excellent selection. They've got Blickman and stuff like that. I bought a hop rocket from them that I've been very happy about. There's also a couple of different shops in the UK. The one that I use is Hampstead Brewing Company, and they're really great. You can get what you need with, some specialized exceptions. So in terms of equipment, I can get the Boilermakers. If I had the money for it, I could anyway. Maybe someone can get me a discount, perhaps. Anyone out there listening?
The difference between wholesale and retail is not that wide. I can just tell you that right now.
I mean, you can eat some of that cost for it. It's, okay. it's a friendship thing.
I won't take the $20 and I'll give it to you. Yeah, well. It is like a $500 item.
Yeah, I know. This is why I haven't bought one yet. But there are options out there. You can get basic kettles, and there are a few places in France. There's a website that I can't remember the name of them right now, but they have basically a clearinghouse for stainless steel items, and you can get. But it's more for people who really want to have a real brewery, like hectoliters size stuff. Yeah. In terms of grain, I actually live about 30 miles, well, no, 30 kilometers, 30 miles, 30 minutes, we'll say 30 minutes, from Franco-Belge Malterie, and they are great. I can go there and pick up 25 kilo sacks of grain whenever I want. They have a huge range of stuff, and that works out pretty well. And also for hops, I actually I have hops in my backyard. We've got Cascade, Centennial, East Kent, and that's it for right now. Threw some East Kent in a session ale that I did recently, and fresh hopped. That was nice.
Of course, there are listeners out there who are saying right now,
France? East Kent isn't in France.
You have Goldings, but they're not in East Kent. That's for you, folks. That's for
gold.
You.
That's not in Fayetteville either. Yeah. So mine are East Fayetteville Goldings.
Yeah, that's just for you guys. Okay.
Well, I could come up with two words to put in front of.
Oh no, no, wait. Just be sure it's in French.
Well,
no, we kid. We love to hear from everybody who gives us the corrections, because it's like, aha, you are listening. Yeah. You're paying attention. So
I changed the sign on my hops to say East Fayetteville Golding.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And I have no problem with pedantry, because I am totally the same way. So it's not a problem. I will correct you if you're wrong. Yeast is sort of the last real ingredient that you need, and there's a Y-Yeast and White Labs distributors, the Humlegarden guys, who have an ad in BYO, I believe. So if you need it, you can look them up there. They sell both types of yeast, and obviously we have Safe Ale or however you want to pronounce it, and then some generic thing that's in like a foil packet that I would never recommend ever. Mm. So just go with the brands, because it, when it comes to yeast, you really don't want to mess that sort of stuff up.
Right.
And the one of the really interesting things about living in Europe is that wild hops are everywhere. We found, well, actually, I did not, my wife. Do you want to tell them about how you found the hops?
Yeah, we live across from a chateau, a castle. That is a huge park, and so that's where I take the baby for a walk every day. And they have a walled part in the back with swamps and lots of nettles and, like, wild herbs that you don't really want. And they were covered with hops. Mm. So I picked a couple, and depends on where you are in the park, but some smell like nothing, and some have really good aroma. I don't know if we used any.
No, we haven't yet.
No.
But I have a plan of doing a collection of the cueillette, is the French, I guess, the clipping harvest. Of a harvest of all of these wild hops that we can find, and doing a beer with wild yeast from right there, you know, having a big, you know, cool ship type of thing. And then the chateau has a glacière, which is, well, you could call it a lagering cave if you want. And I want to do basically a, well,
super local.
Yeah, a hyper-local beer. And if you need to look for it, you can find hops in your backyard if you know where to look. So
you're talking about terroir.
That's yeah.
yeah. You got it right there.
Exactly.
But
these are not East Cairns, but East Chamarand hops.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
Take that, picky people. No, I'm just teasing. We love the, again, we love to hear people who
are passionate about
the hobby and want to straighten us out, because
exactly.
Sometimes we do need straightened out. But you are considering, or you're actively involved in, moving from the home brewing status into the professional brewing status. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Mainly, honestly, I'm a little selfish, and I don't want to have to pay import prices for a beer that I want to drink. So I figure, well, I already brew my own. Let's see how hard it is to open my own brewery and then, you know, spread the good news of good American beer, you know. I did a classic American Pilsner that was named after the division, the patent, General Patton's armored division that stayed in the chateau. And you can go there. There's what's called an orangerie, which is a thing that's like a sealed off, nice, pretty area. And the GIs like carved their initials into the side of it and says, like, you know, 1944 and, you know, 5th Armored or whatever. And so I did a classic American Pilsner in their honor.
Well, cheers to the GIs. Yeah. You got nothing, Andy, yeah. But.
Well, I can lie. Positive,
yeah. Here, share with Andy. Here, there we go. Cheers.
But the brewery.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, I was distracted there for a minute.
Yeah. So the brewery is, it's a work in progress right now. For the moment, it has a production capacity of 10 gallons per batch, which is, you know, very much, it's very much the home brewer scale. The nice thing about being in France is that because you have this very... ancient system of wineries that exist all over the country before modern sanitation. If you were to regulate them, you would then have to regulate anything that produces alcohol. So beer production goes under the same basic guidelines as wine production. And if you were to go to, you know, Monsieur Pierre and tell him, well, I'm sorry, but you have to have stainless steel everywhere and you have to have all this barn, it goes away. You can't put your beer into the, you can't put your wine into these barns anymore. You can't do any of that. He would say, excusez-moi, monsieur. Je pense pas. Then you would be quickly, you know, beaten. I don't know, missing
off the property.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the nicest way to say it. Yeah,
go away before I taunt you a second time.
you beat me to it. There you go. It means that you have a lot of leeway, and so I can actually brew sellable beer on my porch. And so that's what I'm working on doing. And because if you want to start a brewery, you fill out a thing for what's called an auto-entrepreneur, which is a small business for a single person. And you fill out a form online. You say that we want to open a brewery, and you hit submit on the form. And a couple of weeks later, you get your little ID number that you use on invoices, and there you go. You have to claim taxes, of course, but Usually, you know, it's just like in the U.S. where taxes are done cents to the barrel, or maybe it's a few dollars a barrel, I suppose. How much would you say?
I think it's $3 a barrel, or maybe something like that. It's pretty minor compared to how 15 gallons, I guess.
Yeah,
or no, 31 gallons. So
it's more or less the same sort of thing. And so the tax guys are not going to come, you know, knocking at your door because you haven't declared taxes on, you know. It would cost them more in gas to drive to your brewery. Now, the idea is behind auto-entrepreneur in general is that you can start a business and you can see how it goes because it actually expires after 2 years. So the idea for me is to see how it goes. And if it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then that's when, you know, we have to look more closely at doing all the taxes and everything. But, I mean, you still declare everything and that. But the regulation, like the state, local, federal, city, county, zoning board authorizations you have to get from everybody and their grandmother in the U.S., doesn't exist in France that I know of. So it's ridiculously easy. So if it's so easy, I have the equipment to do it already. Why not? You know, it, nothing to lose.
So no federal inspector comes to look at your brewery. No health department people come to look at your facilities. You just do it all online and away you go.
I am.
Maybe I shouldn't have asked that.
Yeah, you don't know my address, right? No, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't say for sure for other people who are considering this in other parts of Europe or France if it is actually okay or not. But I have other brewer friends who have done exactly the same thing, and it's the sort of thing where if the health inspector is going to come by, he lets you know. Depending on how widespread you are, I mean, they have other things to do. You know, it's yeah.
So in this country, you have to the name of your beer has to pass the government hurdles. The label of your beer has to pass the government hurdles. You know, there's somebody at the TTB has to look at what you're doing and to make sure that everything is okay and make sure the government warnings are on there. And you're holding up a bottle and what's it say?
Let me show you the things that are required on a French beer label. You have to have this, which is saying that if you drink this beer, you'll not get pregnant.
I don't think that's what that means.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it says that.
Let me just clarify. That's not the way.
I think it enhances pregnancy.
It's fat ladies with bad backs. But no, I'm just kidding. If you've seen the logo, then you'll get the joke. But no, it's a little tiny logo that's about 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. That's a 1.0563 inches or some. I don't know. I don't like comparing. It's a tiny little logo with a sort of mark through a pregnant lady drinking a glass of wine, which is inappropriate for this because it's beer. And then the alcohol by volume, the name and address of the brewery, and that's about it. But that's not required. You have to have some kind of mark on there just so that people know what it is. But you're not required to have that. You have to have the ingredients, I believe, as well. And then sometimes they have a requirement for l'abus d'alcool est dangereux pour la santé, which is basically saying, you know, beer is bad if you drink too much of it. But I think if you put this little logo of the pregnant lady, then you're pretty much covered. So, but you don't have to get authorization from anybody. You just have to make sure that you have all of the things on there. If you do not and you sell your beer, you can get in trouble because it's incorrectly labeled. But there's no process to go through before you can actually sell anything.
In journalism class, what we have now would be termed as prior restraint. Prior restraint is where you're required to pass your stories in front of the government before they're published. That's essentially what we have now with the beer labeling. You're required to pass it in front of the government authorities before you put it on the bottle and put it up for sale. It sounds like in France, you put it on the bottle, you put it out there, and if it's wrong, if somebody catches you, you get in trouble. But otherwise, no big deal.
Yeah, a lot of things are like that. You know, I was supposed to get a construction permit to build my deck, but I didn't. Another good reason that no one knows my address. But it's already built, so, aha. But, you know, it's pretty relaxed. Because the good thing is about beer is that you can't get sick from making bad beer. You can lose customers, and you can get a lot of people upset at you. But you know, it's more reasonable, shall we say. The other thing that is the downside to lack of labeling requirements and that sort of thing is that the lack of restrictions and things like that in general is that everyone can make beer. Which is great if you're a home brewer, but when you go to a beer shop and you see, a local brewery, it's brewed by some guy with, you know, a 10-gallon system on his porch, and, you know, then you try it, and it's like, whoa, this is infected, what the heck? And it's horrible beer. Well, that everything's on the market, and that's a problem because you have this real need to have a coherent what would you say?
Point of entry. There's got to be a point of... It's useful to have some sort of point of entry into the system so that at least you have some sort of skills, you know, some sort of hurdle to get you into the marketplace. One would think on in one way of thinking of things.
You know, I would actually say that it's not a matter of skill. It should be a minimum of quality. And that's the problem when you have anybody can do it, because anybody will, you know, like me. But I'd like to think that I produce good beer. The problem that I have is with a lot of the breweries that I see out there are just, maybe it's because they don't know any better. Maybe it's because their audiences, their markets don't care. You know, they see, it's a more fancy version of Kolnenbuhl. So they buy it, and it's, you know, just for the label or whatever.
You know, from my perspective, maybe another comparison would be YouTube. Just because you have a video camera and can edit something and post it online doesn't mean that it's good. Yeah. And if you have a system where anybody can do it, yeah, there's a lot more video out there, but the proportion of good video to bad video is, you know, that just makes it harder to find good video. Yeah. So in other words, one of the challenges that you have as a brewer, just because you can get into the market, you have to be able to distinguish yourself from all the other people out there who are doing like you're doing and just jumping into the market unimpeded. I mean, in one way, it's a good thing to get out there and be able to get your stuff out there, as in YouTube. There are people who've been able to distinguish in podcasting. There have been people who've been able to jump out there past the traditional distribution lines and distinguish themselves, you know, from others. But, you know, how do you jump those hurdles? How do you distinguish yourself?
Well, I think a lot of it is going to be word of mouth. You have that, and you have, regular media markets where you have people who write stories about your beer, and, you know, it's usually like a fluff piece that's on, you know, page 22, but, you know, some people read it, and those people see it, and they say, I have a cousin who likes beer. I'll send him this beer, and, you know, there you go, and eventually it builds up from there. You're never going to become anything like a InBev or, you know, Kolnenbuhl who says, but you don't want to. Mm-hmm. So it really has to be... I actually come from a political background. I've worked on several campaigns, in terms of new media and building grassroots support, there are a whole lot of parallels between the way that you run a campaign and the way that you distribute a beer and the way that you get news out there about the beer. So you just have to, you have to know how to manipulate the media, and you have to know how to get people to be interested in your product and your story. But even beyond that, even more important, you have to have good beer. If you have two and you don't have the third thing, then nothing's going to happen.
So, what's going to be your first beer?
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. let's see. How do I phrase this? There's a certain beer that has a very well-known clone recipe, and I will be making the clone and then calling it something else, which is perhaps a bit unscrupulous, but...
You cannot copyright recipes.
Exactly. You can be kind of a not very nice guy and steal other people's ideas. But, hey, I mean, I'm making it in France, so... I'm going to be making a double IPA. We also have a classic American Pilsner that is actually from, I think it was BYO's original article on... Was it BYO that did the Not Your Father's Mustache classic American Pilsner? Was that somebody else?
We'll say yes.
Okay, yeah. So whoever it was. So I'm basically doing that recipe because I love that beer. And a cap is a great entry-level beer for people who are looking for something a little bit more complex but still within their safety zone. So that's the entry-level beer. Then you're going to have, at the upper end, you're going to have the double IPA. And then in the mid-range, we have a couple of different things. We're going to be doing a barley wine that's aged on oak chips. And then we're also going to be doing just a standard English mild session.
So, Tiffin, are you excited?
Oh, yeah, I'm very excited. I really like Phil's beers, and it's just, I used to not really like beers too much, or not care about it too much. Then I came to the U.S. and started liking it, thanks to Sam Adams. Uh-huh. And, no, really, we have to start somewhere. And and since we've been homebrewing, well, mostly Phil, but I really appreciate more and more, and I like more the stout style, but it's okay. You can brew that later.
That's for the personal collection.
Yeah.
You want to tell them the story about the time you asked for an American beer?
Oh, yeah. The very first time I went to a pub in the U.S., and I asked for a good American beer, and they served me a Bud Light. And I didn't like it, actually. For some reason, I was surprised, and I was wondering. But thankfully, I met friends later who told me that was not really a good American beer. And they introduced me to Sam Adams, like, because there was a standard pub in New York, and they didn't have much choice out there. But anyway.
So we're trying to win people over, like, you know, Tiffin is a great market test for me. You know, if she likes it, then, you know, most French people are going to like it. So,
well, they're much. I like Sam Adams. I mean, I don't like some of their beers. I like better than others, but certainly I enjoy their philosophy and their support of home brewers. And you know, they are certainly sticking their neck out for different good, you know, better tasting American beers. So, you know, cheers to Jim Cook and the rest of the Sam Adams folks.
And they do something every year about that. I mean, they do the homebrew, the long shot contest, and they're very passionate about it. And the truth is, their beers have introduced lots and lots of people to the variety of beers that are in the world. You know, you really, you know, you can't say enough about how much they've changed the beer culture in America.
This episode brought to you by, no.
In Sierra Nevada. Yeah.
Who else have we mentioned during the show? Well, this has been, I mean, obviously our discussion will continue off mic, but.
Open those bottles now.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some homebrews that I want to share, as well as the other beers that you've brought, and we'll save some for later in the magic beer fridge, probably. Mm. So, so Phil and Tiffin, thank you very much for visiting, and thank your son, for your wonderful, beautiful son, for being so restful during this time. I enjoyed him during lunch because he was so active and so wanting to play with everything, and it just reminded me of when my boys were small, and I know it's not as it's not as fun, you know, trying to control him and trying to, oh, you know, why can't he sit still for a couple of seconds? But you know, here in a few years, you'll look back and kind of miss those kind of times. So anyway, and good luck on your upcoming child. We don't know who that's going to be. So anyway, thank y'all very much for coming and sharing, we wish you good luck in your new venture, and safe and happy travels.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this is and thanks for the great weather, too. I'd really appreciate that.
Well, thanks again to Philip and Tiffin for a wonderful company and wonderful beer. And thanks, as usual, to Andy for the use of his deck, his happy place. What a great afternoon. Just a fun time. And we wish them all the best of luck in everything that they do. And we look forward to hearing progress reports on how the new brewery is coming along. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. And you can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals on our site to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Donut House Collection Coffee Chocolate, or it's, I guess it's Donut House Collection Coffee Chocolate Glazed Donut, 24-count K-Cups for Keurig Brewers. And Nesco BJX5 American Harvest Jumbo Jerky Works Kit. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next week, everybody. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.